The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
There's an image that comes to mind. In 1986, probably one of the most delicate types of operations in the Israeli army are a search and rescue. And, you know, sometimes life is black and white. It works, it doesn't work. Sometimes it's not so simple. And this is really a case in point. 1986, an Israeli Air Force flight was on a mission into Lebanon, and one of the squadron was hit by a SAM anti-aircraft missile. And some of you may know the story. Ron Arad was taken capture. And what most people don't know are the details of that story. There is a special unit in the Israeli army, which I'm not going to mention because we're on tape, but basically what happens is this is a very unique search and rescue unit, the best of the best. And whenever Israeli Air Force planes cross the border on missions, so this group is in the air. And generally what happens is there are two helicopters that literally hover at the border. And that way, if there's a rescue call, you don't have to wait to scramble, you're already there. And unfortunately, on this particular day, that's what happened. And so this unit sort of went screaming in, guns blazing, into Lebanon. Ron Arad had worked his way to the top of a hill. His pilot, whose name obviously for security reasons you don't share, was further up the hill. What you have to do when you pull a pilot out of harm's way, to be honest, I mean, I was in tanks and we moved slowly. These guys, it's just unbelievable. You basically get lowered on a boom cable. You're going in under fire. You have it's called a bear claw. You're trained to use this bear claw to scoop someone up because you can't really hold them with that kind of force of contact. The pilots are trained to make themselves ready to receive the bear claw. And literally, like in the movies, you swoop in out of the sky and you pick them up to safety. And the reason that there are always two helicopters is because, by definition, hopefully they're a pilot and a navigator. They're two individuals. Obviously, ejection sheets and parachutes, they don't land next to each other. In this particular case, the pilot was rescued, but the commanders in the field decided that the navigator, Ron Arad, was not rescuable. In this case, it was Amal militia was too close to him. They were under heavy fire, and you know, you're putting two squadrons basically at risk, and so they had to turn back. I once met one of the individuals who was involved in that mission. He goes to sleep every night with the face of Ron Arad, who was basically 300 yards away, and they couldn't pull him out. And it raises a number of interesting questions. You know, there's a general question, which is, you know, this seems like a simple thing. I mean, it may be scary to do, it may be difficult to do, but it's a simple thing. If somebody's life is on the line, then you do everything, you know, to save that life. I mean, there's a tradition in the Israeli army that, you know, we bring our boys home. And that means that if you have to risk your life to do that, then that's what you do. But it's not so simple. Is that such a simple question? Is it such a simple question? Are you allowed to risk your life to save another? What you're basically doing is you're placing a value judgment. You're making an assumption that his life is as important as yours. You're possibly making an assumption that his life is more important than yours. Imagine that, you know, God forbid that you know, a politician, the president, the prime minister comes under fire. You're the Secret Service man. You're trained, right, to jump in front of the bullet, which is a psychotic thing to do, to be trained to do. You have to sort of negate all your instincts. That's not a simple question. Are you allowed to do that? Are you allowed to forfeit your life for the benefit of a greater good? Are you allowed to put your life at stake? What things in this world are more valuable than life itself? There's an interesting question. There's a great rabbi by the name of Rav Ephraim Oshri. He was one of the last rabbis in the Kovno ghetto. And he was, you know, at the beginning, in Lithuania, so the Nazis didn't sort of right away unveil their plan for mass extermination, right? And so at the beginning, there were all sorts of facades. Some people saw through them, most people didn't. So they weren't taking older gentlemen off to the labor camps right away. But it must have bothered them that there was this rabbi, this rabbiner, who was kind of walking around and didn't have a job, and they couldn't force him into a labor camp just yet because they weren't doing that. So I guess it must have bothered them. So what they did was they found him a job guarding a warehouse. He was made to guard a warehouse. You have to understand, this is one of the greatest scholars of his generation. You know, the chief rabbi, as it were, and he's standing in front. They got him this ridiculous Keystone Cop outfit, and he's standing in front of a warehouse, and he's guarding this warehouse. And after a couple months, he starts to get curious, why are all these high-ranking Nazi officers walking in and out of this warehouse? So he sneaks a peek, and he discovers that this warehouse is really a collection point for the treasures of what the Nazis believe will soon be the extinct Jewish race. And they're planning a museum, and this is documented at Yad Vashem, they're planning a museum for after the war of the extinct Jewish race. Now, what do you store in such a warehouse, right, that are Jewish artifacts? Most of the Jewish artifacts you might think of, they disappeared, right? They went into Swiss bank accounts, and that's a whole other story in current Jewish history. But the Jewish books were there. So what the Nazis had done, especially since they were systematic in their consciousness, they had filing systems and an organizational structure, they had basically created a library of Jewish books. And so what they'd done is they'd taken a great Torah scholar and they'd given him a library. So people started hearing that Rav Ashri had access to Jewish books, which were, you know, burned and forbidden in the ghetto, and they started bringing him their questions. And while he didn't have the time to pore over the responsum, what he did do was he would write down what their questions were, write down the basic answers that he gave them, and he hid them in tin cans and buried them. And since he survived the war, he went back after the war and dug them up. And he published them in a series of volumes called Mima Makim, From the Depths. And the questions that are in this volume, there's an annotated, edited version, a one-volume version, called The Holocaust and Halacha, which is an incredible book. The questions that these people asked are mind-boggling. You know, can you make a Seder on 4 half cups of water? What blessing do you make if you're forced to eat pig on Yom Kippur? Are you allowed to have an abortion if a Nazi is threatening your life and you know that you'll be killed if you don't? And all those types of questions. And one of the questions that he's asked is, if you're in a death march, are you allowed to step out of the line to help someone who falls by the wayside? Now, you understand that if you don't step out to help this person, it's only a matter of moments before he'll be killed. On the other hand, do you have the right to risk your life for another? And it's interesting that he actually rules in that responsum that you're allowed to do it, but you're not obligated to do it, which is very challenging for us on many different levels. But the question here is, I guess, twofold. One is, are there things in this world that are worth dying for? And most appropriately, since I understand that a lot of the people around here are real estate execs, is land something worth dying for? Now, it could be that, you know, there are deals that you're involved with that you think you'd be willing to die for, I don't know. But obviously, we have a little bit of a different direction with this question. Very difficult question. And, you know, you sort of take a step back and you consider what's going on in the news and what's going on in the world, and it becomes a very difficult question. I mean, some of you have just been to Israel. Those of you who haven't been to Israel, I urge you to go. It's an incredible experience, however you choose to go. I think the UJA and the way that you guys just went is an awesome way to do it. Plug, plug, plug for whoever's here. Right?
We're going again next year.
Next year, okay. Right. But it's very hard sitting in America, maybe even post 9/11, but certainly pre, to understand this connection to land. And at the end of the day, land is a thing. It's an object. And if you lose land, so you lose land, you lose a piece of something. Is it worth the sacrifice? Is it worth dying for? That's the first question. And I want you to know, we talked about this in Israel, but just so everybody's on the same page, you know, there was a time when this wouldn't have been a discussion. In 1948, when the Jewish people made a collective decision that we needed to have our own home, right? They had a mission, they believed in that mission, and they accomplished that mission. I think the reason they accomplished that mission was because they had no choice. We had nowhere else to go. We didn't have a choice. The Jewish people's future was at stake. But that's not the case anymore. We do have a choice. You know, this room is evidence that we have a choice. You can live in America, you can live in South America, you can even go back to Germany. Which forces us to ask the question, is the price that we continue to pay for land, is it worth it? On a different level, such sacrifices bespeak a certain altruism. And we generally have this idea that the goals that we have, the purpose that we exist, the things we try to accomplish, that when we can tap into something that isn't about ourselves, that's really about something bigger, these altruistic goals, that's really what it's all about, right? I mean, that seems to be the purpose. I just saw an email, you know, that Steven Spielberg was interviewed. Maybe somebody saw this, so you can help me out here. But Steven Spielberg was interviewed on some E! Entertainment or whatever, and he was being asked about the movie that he made, Schindler's List. I don't know if you know this, but he didn't take a penny of the proceeds from that movie. He dedicated all of it to Holocaust research and the Shoah project that he has about, you know, memorializing the stories of those you know, Holocaust survivors. And he was asked why he did that, and he said, well, because that's blood money. I don't want to make a penny off the Holocaust, you know, which is a very powerful idea. And you think that's tremendous, right? I mean, here it doesn't matter. I don't know him as an individual. Can't judge all of his projects. But in that moment, he's having a purely altruistic moment. He's doing something which hopefully is not about himself. And that's good. You want to feel that you're doing things that are not about yourself. By the way, even on the level of real estate and on business in general, you know, sometimes rabbis have the perspective, you know, that, you know, there's the rabbi, the scholar, the social tikkun olam workers, people who are doing good in the field, and there are the businessmen who need to support them, and so business is some sort of a necessary evil because that's how we run institutions. But that's not really true. I mean, when you really think about what business does on a certain level, I mean, imagine a major corporation, General Motors. I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people who have livelihoods, who have jobs, who have safety, who have security, who have peace, who fund all of their own projects, all because of one company. And you could probably put all of the success of that one company and put it against all the other nonprofits in America, and I'm not sure who would come out ahead. So it's almost not about what you do, but about why you do it, right? And if you can do things for the right reason, and it's not about yourself, that's tremendous. Except for one detail. And I have to say, when I first came across this, you know, one of the challenges that you have, and I grew up traditional, and I lived in, you know, this world for a long time, and I actually discovered Israelite. It was interesting. Israelite is, I don't even know if you know what Israelite is, but Israelite is an organization that basically seeks to create a renaissance in Jewish education, you know, give people an opportunity to experience Jewish content in a very non-confrontational, open-minded atmosphere. People come to our table from every Jewish background you can imagine. I'll get Reform rabbis sitting with yeshiva students from the Mir, and the ability to create dialogue and open minds. It's just a wonderful thing. And it's interesting, you know, that one of the tremendous gifts, and I think, you know, we've spoken about this before, one of the gifts that the student brings to the teacher is that we get to see things through eyes that are so different. You know, when we walk around the Old City, so there's something very powerful. And I work in the Old City. We have a center. It's an incredible building. You'll come visit. Right? Plug, plug, plug. But, you know, it's a dangerous thing because if you work every day in the Old City, so maybe you take it for granted. But every time I walk into the Old City with a group of students that have never seen it before, I get to see it all over again. And that's true for study as well, right? So this is an example of something that I must have read 100 times. I must have studied this so many times until someone pointed this out and we got into this discussion, and I realized that there's something really wrong here. Where is the first place that you come into contact in the Bible, in the Torah, with the concept of the land of Israel? Where's the first place? What do you think?
Exodus.
Pardon? Exodus is when we're heading there, but Lech Lecha is the first time we go. Now, it's a trick question, because you're thinking national, so there really is no Jewish people until Exodus, that's true, and you're thinking individual, right? The first Jew is Abraham. It's an interesting question, why Abraham is the first Jew, why Noah isn't the first Jew, but let's take for a moment that the first Jew is Abraham, right? And it's interesting that Abraham, we know very little. We know almost nothing, in fact, nothing in the Torah about where he came from, how he came up through the ranks, right? Our introduction to him, he's already 75 years old. Judaism does not believe in early retirement, right? And he has his first conversation with God. He's never had a conversation with God. Now, you would think he's living in a morass of idolatry. He's living in a time where monotheism isn't a blip on the horizon. Nobody's thought about this. Paganism makes more sense. I mean, if you've got lots of different gods and one of them isn't working, you know, you've hedged your bets. If you've only got one and it's not working, that's why therapy is so successful today. Back then, you had other gods you could go to, it worked, right? So finally God deigns to visit the one individual who believes in him. So what is God's first line, right? Lech lecha, go. It's a very strange thing. I would think the first thing God should say is, you know, listen, come, let's sit, let's talk, come for a cup of coffee. You don't know what Starbucks is, that's a few thousand years away, but I'll tell you, right? We could have a whole discussion. It would be, by the way, a great class. If the first thing God had ever said to Avram would have been, bo, then we could have had a great class, but we can't have the class because that's not what he said, right? So God says, lech, go. By the way, just as an aside, this is a theme in Judaism. The concept of halicha, of going, you know, best example I can think of is Friday night. Some of you may be more familiar with the Friday night service. There's a song, it's a beautiful song, that was composed in the hills of Tzfat by a Kabbalist named Rav Shlomo Alkabetz. And it is the song. Everybody knows the song. Do you know what I'm thinking of on Friday night? We sing it. Lecha Dodi. Do you ever wonder about that? Do you know what the words Lecha Dodi mean? Right? Lecha Dodi means, go, my beloved. Go, my... It's such a story when you get married, you finish the wedding, you come home, you stand in the middle of the kitchen and you say to your wife, go! It's a little strange. We start the Kabbalat Shabbat service. Lechu Nuranina, go. You know, it's almost as though in Judaism, in fact, there's an interesting Mishnah, there's an interesting teaching in Ethics of the Fathers. In this world, you never say to somebody, right, Lech Bishalom, go in peace. You always say Lech Lishalom, go to peace. The only time you actually say Lech Bishalom, go in peace, in other words, you've arrived, is when you're lowering the body into the grave. Because in this world, we're on a journey. And I don't know that we're supposed to get there. In fact, if you think you've gotten there, probably you're further away than you think, right? And that's what I always focused on, you know, with this particular section. But there is another piece. The other piece is, what does it mean, lech lecha? Go to you. Now, before we get to that, it's interesting, right? Lech lecha me'artzecha mimolaretcha mibet avicha. God says to go from your land, right? From your neighborhood where you grew up, from the house of your father. Before you can go somewhere, you have to let go of where you're coming from, and that I understand, right? Ela aretz asher areka, to the land that I will show you. Which is really the question here. Why is God's initial relationship with Abraham about land? What does it matter where you are? In fact, I would have thought that if Abraham's goal is to become a role model for making a better world, to create an ethical society, then I would think he should stay where he is. Because by staying where he is, where he has contacts, if he can be a role model for human ethics, then he has an opportunity to influence the world. Instead, he leaves. He's supposed to go off to this place where no one knows him. Unless he has a dark past, what's the point of that? Why does it have to be about space? And I have a friend who believes, and you can agree or disagree, we're going to talk for about another 15, 20 minutes, and then I'm going to open the floor, because I would have much rather have a good discussion than, you know, watch you listen to a lecture. But his opinion, and you can tell me what you think of this, is that the single biggest problem today in the world, especially in the Middle East, is the concept of sacred space. I want to play an interesting game next time you have a party. Try this. It's a lot of fun. You know those globes, they sit on a stand, you know, nicer or worse, right? Put one on your dining room table, right, your coffee table, have a party, and play the Let's Find Israel game. You ever try this? Especially when you have friends who aren't Jewish, who don't know that map or whatever it might be, they can't find it. It's ridiculous how much energy is put into this little piece. I mean, the word Israel can't even fit inside the country, right? It's got to have that line. And you kind of take a step back and you wonder, what's the big deal? You know, we were offered a state in Uganda, right, at the first Zionist Congress. Herzl, by the way, voted he wanted to have the state in Uganda, and that's a whole other discussion. What's the big deal where you are? Doesn't it matter who you are? That's the second question. And sometimes it really hits you. You know, the price that you pay. And there's certain times in your life where you struggle with this. We all do this on different levels. I remember, this is in the summer of 2001, I guess some of you know this, but I was in a pizzeria. I was set to come to America. I spent 3 years in America building up Israelite, basically. And about 4 days, 5 days before I was supposed to get on the plane, I went to a pizzeria in town and just walked in to have a regular afternoon lunch. And a homicide bomber, walked in, blew himself to pieces. And I vividly remember this experience. You know, I was in the middle of reading a book, and the single loudest noise I have ever heard in my life, and mind you, I've been under artillery fire, And it takes you a second. You don't realize there's an unbelievable quiet. Has anybody ever been in a car accident? Right? You know, like after a car accident, there's that moment of silence. Like there's no silence like the silence after a car accident, right? That's what this is like. There's just this intense silence. And then the screaming begins. And you know, you start to hear all different sorts of noises. And people start to panic. And, you know, you calm everybody down. We were sitting. The only reason that I'm still sitting here is because when you walked into this Spiro's Pizzeria, there were a few steps in the back that led to like a back room, probably about this size. And I happened to sit back there, you know. And it's the little details in life. I remember I was standing in line. I wanted to get a big ziti. And I was standing in line, and there was this little girl having a fit, you know, just like only little five-year-old girls can have. And I remember you go through this sort of, it's not even a conscious decision-making process. Right? It's just a thought. You know, I'm so tired. I have like 15 minutes. I just need some peace and quiet. You know what? The table I was looking at, you know how you go into a restaurant, you scope out, you know, you pick your table. So I was looking at this table. It was just convenient. It was by the door. There was a breeze. And then this little girl starts screaming. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to sit in the back. Only after I sat down did I see that this girl was actually in the back. Turned out, I read later, that she was having a temper tantrum because her mother wanted to sit at that same table. And she wanted to sit in the back. And I remember the mother was like balancing two trays. And you know, that's the battle of wills. And they always win, right? And so, so she took her daughter to the back. That little five-year-old girl's temper tantrum absolutely saved my life, you know? And then I remember coming down the steps, and there was a woman whose eyes will stay with me forever. She was trying to say something. And, you know, they teach you in first aid in the Army that the first thing you have to do is you have to establish contact, you know, try to see if they know their name, if they know where they are. And while I'm trying to do this, you could literally see the lights go out. You know, the eyes just dim, and Mamash just died on the steps there. And I always wonder what she was trying to say, and then the screaming and the things that, you know, aren't worth repeating around lunch. I mean, just what you have to walk through until you finally, you know, the ambulance has come and you get outside. And you walk away thinking, is this worth it? I'm not putting aside for the moment, you know, that's what they want us to think, but just on a purely intellectual level, is it worth it? Why is this land so important? What do we need a piece of land for? And the second question, which challenges me even more on a certain level, right, is why are we doing all this? Now, understand this question. If really there is a value to altruism, to doing things, because we believe that we want to tap into things that are bigger than we are, so listen to this. This is very interesting. The verse says, it's the beginning of the portion of Lech Lecha, and if anybody afterwards wants to know where this is, I'll be glad to share it with you. Lech Lecha me'artzecha, so what are the words Lech Lecha, literally go towards yourself, which may mean to discover yourself, which I can understand. So Rashi, Rav Shlomo Yitzchaki, is probably the greatest commentary in the Torah. When you get into Bible study, he's the man, you know, everybody studies him. Brilliant, lived in 1040 to 1105 in Provence. Why do I want you to go? I want you to go to you, for your pleasure, and for your own good. That's a very strange line. Sham there escha l'goy gadol, I'm going to make you a great nation. Now Rashi's commenting on the verse, because the verse says, right, the verse continues, go from your land, etc., from your home, from your father's house, to the land that I will show you, right? And I'm going to make you a great nation. And I will bless you. And I'm going to make your name great. That's very interesting. There's an idea in Jewish tradition that there are 10 tests that Abraham undergoes. Whatever a test is. This is the first. And I understand this is a serious test to leave everything you know behind. To go off to some land you've never seen. The last, of course, is the binding of Isaac. That's a whole other discussion. What's interesting, by the way, right, is that in the last of these tests, at the binding of Isaac, when God comes to Abraham and says, I want you to take your son, your only son, that you love so, Yitzchak, and I want you to offer him up as an offering, whatever that means, same language, right? Lech lecha, right? You have to go towards yourself, onto one of the mountains that I will show you, Mount Moriah, right? Alecha de'arim asher omar lecha. The mountain that I will show you. Same pattern. So, I understand that this is on a certain level a test unless you stop to think about it. Think about it. If God comes to you, you know, you could debate whether God exists. I may think God does exist, you may think God doesn't exist, but if God exists, right? I don't personally feel you can prove God's existence. I think you can know that God exists, but I don't think you can prove it. But the one that could prove that God exists is God. So if you're talking to God, right, if you're really talking to God, I have to assume that you know you're talking to God. So if God came to you and you know you're talking to God, and God says, I want you to go, walk out into the Mojave Desert to a place that I will show you, and I will make you great. I will make you a great nation. And I will make your name great. I'll make you famous. Va'avarechacha. I'll make you wealthy. So what's the test? Duh. Obviously. Right? I mean, what's the big deal? In fact, this whole portion is all about the fulfillment of this promise. Avram becomes famous. He becomes wealthy. It describes how he has mekneh rav, much cattle. And he even discovers his first progeny because he's given a son, Yishmael. So the whole point of this parsha, of this portion, is that God comes to Abraham and says to Abraham, listen, this is what I want you to do for me. I want you to leave home. Go to a land that I will show you, where I will make you famous, where I will give you progeny. And I will understand, you know, you're 75 years old. According to some opinions, you're 90 years old. You don't have any children. And God comes along and tells you that you're going to have a son. I mean, what greater reward than that? So what's the big deal? Of course you would do it. And more than that, what does this mean? Even more than that, why is God telling Avraham, I want you to do this letovatcha, for your own good, ulahanatcha, and for your pleasure? Now think about this for a minute. If this is in fact part of the promise, it means that if you do this, but you don't do it for your own good, right? If you do this simply as an altruistic measure, then you've actually failed. I want you to do this for yourself. Right? And if you're not doing this for yourself, that seems to be what the verse intends, then you're not doing what I want you to do. So I want you to want to be rich. Now, I don't know about you. I'm up to that test. It will be challenging, but I'm up to it. You know? I want you to have children. I want you to want to have children. I'm up to that. And people are looking around, who am I talking to? Right? Yeah. So what's the test here? Well, what's the message here? What's the point? And you walk out of a place like Sbarro's, you know, and you ask yourself both those questions. I mean, is it worth it? Could anything be worth that? I mean, if George Bush said, you know what, this is too complicated. Here's what we're going to do. The state of the union in America that has the least per capita land populated, if I'm not mistaken, is the state of Wyoming. Okay, in Wyoming, they have one person for every 200 miles. Right? So instead of, you know, disengagement and pushing out 8,000 Jews, we'll push out 15 cowboys, and we'll have a state of Israel, the size of the state of Israel. We'll bring all the Jews over, right? If you believe all the rumors, you know, the next thing you know, industry will be unbelievable. It'll be good for everybody. What's the difference where we are? Why is this worth it? That's first of all. And second of all, are we supposed to be doing this for some altruistic purpose? Or is the message here that somehow we're not supposed to be doing it for altruistic purposes? Somehow we're supposed to want what? Well, what is God telling Avram here? Why is it that at least according to the verse, and according to Rashi's perception of this verse, that you do this letovatcha ulehanatcha, for your own benefit? So listen to this idea. And by the way, maybe just one last thought. There is Maimonides, who lived in the 12th century, was a master organizer. And he has a number of different great works. And one of them is called the Yad HaChazaka, which is really, it's called the Yad, Yud Dalet. Yud is the 10th letter in the alphabet. Dalet is the 4th. It's really 14 books that encompass the totality of Jewish tradition, Jewish law. And of course, the Rambam did this. I mean, he culled the sources from the entire Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud, the Midrashim, rabbinic legends, the Bible, the prophets. He must have had an encyclopedic mind. He did this, obviously, before computers. And up until Rambam's time, if you wanted to study the laws of Shabbat, you had to go through the entire Talmud to discover where these laws were. Not in Aramaic. The Rambam was able to create a concise system where if you needed to study the laws of Shabbat, as an example, or the laws of keeping kosher, you could look in one place. So the Rambam has a set of laws called the laws of repentance. Now, repentance really isn't a good word. It's not a good translation because it's not really a Jewish word. In Judaism, the word is tshuva. Tshuva, maybe you've heard that word. Tshuva means lashuv, to go back. Can I go back to who I was meant to be, right? You make a mistake. I don't know, somebody leaves a wallet on a table. You walk in. You're at a crossroads. You have an opportunity to do the right thing, do the wrong thing. You make a mistake. You pick up the wallet, you slide it into your pocket, and you walk out of the building, right? So you failed. And then sort of you realize, you know what? I don't want to be that person. So you want to do tshuva. So how do you do tshuva? How do you go back? That's what you're really trying to do, to go back to who you were meant to be, to the person who could never take that wallet in the first place. So there are actually laws. There's a system for how one accomplishes this. The first stage is you have to have charata, you have to have regret. The second stage is you have to have hakarat, or really the first stage is you have to have hakarat achet. You have to recognize your mistake. Second is that you have to have charata, you have to regret it. And the third is you have to decide you're going to do something about it. And how does one do that, etc. So listen to this. In the 10th chapter of the Laws of Tshuva, in which the Rambam delineates, Maimonides delineates the ideal, he says a very interesting thing. Al yomar adam, a person should not say, Hareni oseh mitzvot ha-Torah ve'osek b'chachmata, kidei she'akabel kol ha-brachot ha-ktuvot ba, in order that I should receive all the blessings that are in it. Maimonides says, don't do the mitzvot, don't fulfill whatever Judaism has to offer, because you want the rewards that the Torah gives you, right? That's not the way to serve God. That's not the way to develop a relationship with God. Ha'uved mi'ava, a person who serves out of love, a person who wants to develop a deep relationship with God, oseik b'Torah, involves himself in Torah and good deeds and ethics, lo mipnei davar ba'olam, not because of any other thing in the world, v'lo mipnei yirat ra, not because he's afraid of evil, of purgatory or punishment or whatever things that I don't personally think are part of Judaism, right? Elo seh emet mipnei shu emet. He does truth because it's truth. Umalez zohi maleg gdola meod. And this character is a great character, to be able to do things just because they're right. Fihi, you ready for this? Fihi malat Avram Avinu. And this is the character trait of Abraham. The Rambam says that the ultimate in altruism is Abraham. The person who does it just because it's meant to be done, just because it's true, not for reward, not out of fear of punishment, just because it's the right thing to do. So then how can the Torah tell me, Lich lecha, and Rashi suggests, La'anatcha, utovatcha, you should do this for you. So I'll tell you one way of looking at this, and there are a lot of different commentaries, and the truth is I want you to know that answers are less valuable than questions. If you don't know the answer, you don't agree with the answer, you forget the answer, if the question bothers you and you're struggling with it and you're thinking about it, then that made this class worthwhile. But I'll give you a quick thought. Maybe what letovatcha means, when you really stop to think about it, right, is ultimately the challenge that we have in this world, right, is really all about me. The mission, if you want to call it a mission, that I have to accomplish, what I'm put here for, is exactly and only about me. Because the real question is, who is the me? Who am I? And am I who I could be? And how do I become who I could be? On a certain level, what God is telling Abraham, when you really stop to think about it, is before you change the world, you first have to change yourself. We get so ambitious. We love the numbers. We love the big projects. It's exciting. You know, we want to change the world, we want to change horizons, we want to transform destiny, and that's wonderful. But it's much, much more difficult to change ourselves. You know, I once heard a story of Rav Shlomo Kalbach, right, who, you know, some of you may have heard of. He was known as the singing rabbi, and he, you know, I wasn't a Kalbachian chassid, but I did have the privilege to meet him a number of times, and you could learn a lot from how this person embraced life, you know? And he really took on the students who nobody else would take on. He opened up a place called the House of Love and Prayer, if you've ever heard about this, out in Berkeley, during the height of the 60s, you know, peace, love, brotherhood, right? And he used to hang out with what he called the Holy Hippalach, right? The hippie dippies. And, you know, he became better known. He was a rabbi. He was a genius and happened to have tremendous Torah scholarship. And he gave all that up, the ability to be a great rabbi, just to take his guitar and to reach the people that nobody else would talk to. Right? And to teach them a different way to get high, right? anyway, he was doing a concert out in California, and this was already, he was well known. So there were thousands of people who showed up to this concert. And, you know, at his concerts, especially in the early 70s, I mean, you know, you didn't need to smoke anything. You could just walk in, you would get high, right? Like, there was enough in the air that you could, right? They used to pump it in, right? And so he's having this concert, and, you know, they're all singing songs of love and brotherhood and peace and Oseh Shalom, and we're all going to wrap hands and change the world. And at one point he says, you know, brothers, sisters, says, we need to start a movement for world peace. And everybody goes, world peace, yeah, we're going to world peace, right? He says, do you want to start a movement for world peace? Yeah, we're going to start a movement for world peace, great, world peace, right? Great, right? Then he says, okay, you know what? I say we start this movement for world peace right now, right here, tonight. And everybody goes, world peace here tonight, it's great. And I guess he planned this, he snaps his fingers, and all of a sudden all the lights go on. You know, you're in a show or the movies, and the lights come on, right? And you're like, you know, you got to look around, right? And he says, here's what I want you to do. I want you to make peace, real peace, world peace, with the four or five people sitting right next to you. That would be unbelievable. And it's like silence in the room, you know? I got to make peace with the idiot who keeps talking. I got to make peace with the schnook who sat down in front of me with a hat. No, 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 I don't want to make peace with this idiot. I want to make world peace. And that's part of our challenge, you know? We're very good at our plans for world peace. Can you make peace with the fellow sitting next to you? You know? It's like prayer. It's like tefillah. You know, it's very easy to have a meaningful experience, whatever tefillah, whatever prayer is, when you're out on a mountaintop in the beauty of nature. But if you can have a meaningful experience sitting in a synagogue next to the other 200 people that you have to put up with every year, that's much more challenging on certain levels. Maybe what this verse is saying, lech lecha, is that you have to go and find yourself. Before we can become a people that changes, we have to become individual changes, which brings me full circle back to the last question. And then we'll open up the floor. So what does that have to do with land? Why do I need to be in a certain place, in any place, in order to change who I am? That's really about what this is about. And I always used to think that this was really just about the idea of being a role model. In order to be a role model, you know, I mean, they say that we're the chosen people. And people make a mistake and they think that that somehow means that we're better than anybody else, which is not true. To be chosen doesn't mean that you're better than anybody else. Because if you really stop to think about it, you know, if God created every human being in the world, then every human being is chosen. Everybody's chosen. You know, if you have four children, you have four chosen children. And if one of them is chosen for something particular, it doesn't mean he or she is better than the other three. It just means that for that particular moment, they're best suited for that particular idea. So if every nation is chosen, the only question is what they're chosen for. And the Jewish people, just like every other people, have a gift to give to the world. Right? Buddhists have a gift to give to the world. Catholics have a gift to give to the world. Even the French have a gift to give to the world, right? So the question ultimately is, what is our gift to give to the world? And if our gift to give to the world is to be somehow a light, to be a model, then in order to be a model, we have to be visible. And in order to be visible, we have to have a place. You're not really a nation if you don't have a land. And that's what I always thought. But I think it's a little deeper than that. Because I think maybe, and I'm very curious, to be honest, about this topic from your perspective, because, you know, my wife, on a much smaller level, my wife, for a while, did real estate. You know, she was like a real estate agent. And one of the things that she loved to do, right, was to make that shidduch, you know, to make that partnership. She got into it, in fact, because the real estate agents in the places that we lived just kept messing it up, and she would have, you know, friends would come, especially Americans. And, you know, when you come to Israel, if you meet the right Israeli, it's an incredible experience. If you meet the wrong Israeli, you know, then it's a 10-day trip, right? You know? And so she just kept noticing that the particular agents in her area were not exactly in tune with the American mindset. So she decided to try her hand at this, and she loved doing it. And the thing that she loved most about it was that moment of partnership where you bring a person into a home. And she felt it was like a tremendous responsibility, because if you put a person into a home and it's really for them and it suits them and it's what they're looking for, then that's an unbelievable gift that you've given somebody. And if you put them into the wrong home because you're a good salesman, you may have done them a terrible disservice. I imagine that as much as that's true for individuals in the home, when you talk about, you know, industrial real estate or companies or buildings, that must be a huge question. You know, if you're creating some sort of a neighborhood of condominiums and you don't realize that there's pollution in the area and you've just brought thousands of people with their lives, I mean, that's a huge responsibility, right? on a certain level, there is an energy to place. How a place impacts me. What it allows me to do, you know? Some people, they really connect to being in the woods. Some people need to be by the beach. Some people need space. Some people need company. There's an interesting Talmudic saying. The Gemara says that every person, every Jew, has their four amot, their four cubits in the land of Israel. In other words, there's actually a physical piece somewhere in the land of Israel that is connected to you, whether you know it or not. I always thought that that was allegorical. I really did. And I could give you a whole class on why that allegory is a beautiful idea. Until I had a very interesting experience. You've heard of Birthright? Birthright Israel, right? So we were on Birthright groups, right? And we had a Birthright group, and there was a girl who came on this trip. And you know how sometimes you walk into a room and you meet somebody, and they're just giving off that leave me alone energy, right? You know, you walk into a meeting, and the person's sitting like this and says, come on in. Or you walk into a meeting, and the person's like this, yeah? Right? Like, you don't have to say anything. So this girl had that energy, right? She's just, the whole first 5-6 days, she's just walking around like this. Right? You know, we went down Friday night to the Kotel. I mean, you know, and we did this, we have this rooftop that overlooks the Mount of Olives and the Temple Mount, and you know, the sun is starting to lower itself, and the Jerusalem of gold, the stones are turning, you know, golden orange in the sun, and you're playing guitar, and then you walk down the steps. And, you know, I'm a big believer in the fact that the Kotel, at the end of the day, it's a wall. It's a beautiful wall. It's a wonder. It's a wall! And what makes it special is not, you know, there's some mystical, magical sense to its stones, but the fact that Jews have been connected to that wall for so long. And I think, especially when you have a young group, I mean, Birthright Israel students have never been to Israel before, and most of them at all, right, they very often have very little background, so they come sometimes with these grand expectations, and then they beat themselves up because they get to the Kotel, and they're not crying. You don't have to cry at the wall. It's a wall. Enjoy whatever you enjoy. This girl, I didn't have to give that speech to. You know, she stood on the side, we're all singing, and she's sitting inside like this. She couldn't figure it out. Right? And that's okay. Like, I like the fact that there are different energies and everybody has their space. Anyway, 7th or 8th day of the trip, we go up north, and we spent the morning in the Golan Heights with the whole story of the Yom Kippur War and the Valley of Tears, and just unbelievable stories that are there. And we're sitting in Emek HaBacha in the Valley of Tears, and I'm telling them the story of the 77th Battalion and how a handful of men saved the state of Israel and all. You can't not be moved by that story. She's still sitting there like this. Right? It's okay. You know, I don't have an agenda. Fine. We get to Tzfat, okay? Some of you know where Tzfat is. Tzfat is like the mystical city. It's the highest altitude in Israel, and I think it's also the highest place in Israel, right? You have to be a certain type of person to live in Tzfat. I could never live in Tzfat. That's like the crunchy granola capital of Israel, right? I mean, you know, hippy-dippy land par excellence. This girl gets off the bus, I kid you not. She gets off the bus in Tzfat. We only have 3 hours. And her eyes bug open. She starts walking around. She wanders through the artist colony. You know, and she just disappears. You know, we have like a range. And a couple hours later, we're all meeting by the bus stop, and I see her. She's sitting with like 4 or 5, you know, guys who are wearing these big white Supol Breslov yarmulkes, right? And she's just singing with them. And I was like amazed. I said to her, how you doing? She goes, what is this place? I said, well, you know, this is Tzfat, right? This is for weird people, you know? I mean, however you look at it, right? I mean, don't get me wrong. And you know, people study Kabbalah and they go to Tzfat. And then, by the way, don't misunderstand me. I mean, it's an incredible place. 3 hours later, we're about to get on the bus. She comes to me and she goes, can I stay here? I said, I'm not sure what you're asking me. What do you mean? We're going back to Jerusalem. She goes, no. I really want to stay here. Can I stay over tonight? You know, I'm 22 years old. I'm an adult. I said, yeah, if you really want to. You know, there's a place called Livnot Libanot. Maybe some of you heard of it. And I called them up. I said, look, there's a girl. She really wants to stay here. You know, I don't mind. They didn't mind. So she stayed overnight. This girl just found her place. Couldn't explain it to you. Don't understand it. Except to wonder. And I get very nervous when people give the answers. But except maybe to wonder. What if, in order to accomplish what we're meant to accomplish in this world, we can never really achieve our full potential unless we find our place. Now, there are lots of different pieces to finding that place. Some of that is who you spend your life with. Finding the right person is part of finding your place. And part of it is tapping in to who you are and where you come from and maybe even where you're going. Part of that is place. And if all of those things can come together in one spot at one time, then you have the ability to reach a whole different level. And maybe that's what God is telling Abraham 4,000 years ago. this place is your place. Now, I can't tell you that I have to understand it. I think one of the challenges in this world is to be able to let go of the things we can't understand. You know, I don't understand why one of my kids is artistic and one of my kids is musical. I had this theory when you know, the kids were little. I thought that boys play with boys' toys and girls play with girls' toys because we've conditioned them to do that, right? And I was, you know, we were young students, and I was a rabbinical student, and they had money, and we had a daughter. And then the second child came along, a boy. I thought, like, what a waste to buy boys' toys. And what's the difference if he plays with a dollar at G.I. Joe? You know, it doesn't bother me. He'll be a happy child, you know. Let him have pink toys and grow and be sensitive, right? Didn't work. Hit 3 years old. He wants to play with trucks. He wants to play with G.I. Joes. Doesn't matter. It's very hard to figure that out because they're so different. And each of my children is so different. And I couldn't tell you that I could understand why any one of those children was given that particular gift. But I can tell you with absolute certainty that if we have the chance to figure out, you know, as parents, if we can figure out what our children's gifts are and help them to develop those gifts, then they can become who they're meant to be. And if we put aside those gifts, if they don't discover them, then a part of who they could be gets lost forever. And I wonder if that isn't true as a nation. We connect to a place because it's a part of our being able to become who we are. And part of the challenge of this particular mindset is that it's not something you can quite make tangible. It's not something you can quite put into words. And so God says to Avram, I want you to know that what I'm asking you to do, I'm doing for you. I want you to do this for you because you will be able to become you only in this place.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.